Walt Disney once said that for every laugh, there should be a tear, which is why I think, anyway, he would have loved Drawn to Life, that hugely entertaining, surprising, and emotional spectacle, which is now being presented live on stage at Disney Springs in Lake Buena Vista, Florida. Presented by Cirque du Soleil and Disney, this is a show that I can guarantee you will captivate audiences of all ages. Drawn to Life is a must-see, family-friendly spectacle that will leave you, well, in awe. So don't miss out on your chance to be part of the magic. Plan your visit to Disney Springs today and reserve your seats for Drawn to Life by Cirque du Soleil and Disney live on stage. Set your imagination in motion.
Welcome back to another edition of the Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It's me, Len Testa, and this is our show for the week of Schmurz Day, May 6th, 2024. And happy Mother's Day this week to all of the moms out there. On the show today, news and listener questions. Then in our main segment, Jim and I look back at Stitch's Supersonic Celebration, one of the shortest-lived attractions in Disney theme park history. Let's get started by bringing in the man who notes that less crime is committed on Mother's Days than any other day of the year, which makes you wonder what Mama's up to when you're not around, eh? It's Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
It's going well, Len. And speaking of criminal matriarchs, I want to take a moment to honor the memory of Kate Barker, a.k.a. Ma Barker.
Ma Barker, yeah.
Ma Barker. Yeah. She and her sons went on a bank robbing and kidnapping spree across the American Midwest in the 1930s, and it ended badly for Ma. Back in January of 1935, the FBI came a-callin' one morning while she and the family were holed up in their hideout, which, by the way, located on the shores of Lake Weir in Florida. Shots were fired, Len, and, well, let's just say Kate didn't get a Mother's Day card that year.
A shame.
But, in a weird sort of way, Kate lives on. Kate Barker and her sons Henry, Lloyd, Arthur, and Fred were the inspiration for Ma Beagle and her sons Burger, Bank Job, and Babyface, a.k.a. the Beagle Boys, who continually bedevil Scrooge McDuck and are constantly trying to get into his money bin and get that number one dime.
Oh, that's it. All right, there you go. So they do live on.
They do live
on. In pop culture.
There we go.
That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. All right. Good job. Done. All right, Jim, let's do a quick shout out to all of our Patreon subscribers. Thanks to everyone who subscribes to the show over at patreon.com/Jim Hill Media, including Michael Lang, Cynthia Hobgood, Elise Chule, Jason Blumenthal, Reed Gillette, and John Thompson. Hey, John. Jim, these are the Spaceship Earth cast members who cut and paste the image of your head into the Your Future video at the end of the ride. They say that most of the time, if your hair doesn't look exactly right, it's because the team had to edit it out to get those gorgeous, gorgeous eyes of yours into the film. True story.
Okay, well, now...
Always working to make your vacation better, Jim. That's what I'm saying.
I love that dedication.
On to the news. Folks, the news is sponsored by TouringPlans.com. TouringPlans helps you save time and money at theme parks like Walt Disney World. Check us out at touringplans.com. All right, Jim, first big bit of news. Universal provided last week more details on the upcoming Super Nintendo World for Epic Universe, and it includes three attractions. And the first one of them, Mario Kart Bowser's Challenge, you and I did at Universal Studios Hollywood last year, right?
We did. I want to stress that I did it very poorly. You know, hand-eye coordination, use of the visor, the whole thing. But it was still an amazing physical print plant, and love wandering through that hyper-detailed queue. So anxious to get another swing at the ride when it opens in Florida next year.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about Super Nintendo World in Orlando versus Hollywood is that it's going to be much bigger and taller in Orlando than in Hollywood, because they're really, really space limited out there.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
The other two attractions, Yoshi Adventure, which is a kids ride described as like a people mover type experience around the lower level of the Super Nintendo World land. So you ride a ride vehicle, and I guess you're on some sort of, it's almost like a kids version of a shooting gallery. You have to identify all the Yoshi eggs that have been stolen, and as you find them, as you see them along the ride, you press a button for Captain Toad to spot it, and at the end of the ride, they tally up how many eggs you found, and that's your score. So, interesting variation on like a Buzz Lightyear type game for kids.
I agree.
Then the other one is Donkey Kart Minecart Madness, which Universal is billing as a family-friendly roller coaster that simulates the minecart levels from Donkey Kong Country. I'm not that familiar with all of the different variations of Donkey Kong Jim, what is Donkey Kong Country? Is this like the Beyonce album that we just came
out? Yes, this is the country variation, Len. That's exactly.
Right. Okay.
I will say this much. I too am not as fluent in my Donkey Kongs as I should be, but I thanks to His Eminence BioReconstruct, we've been keeping close tabs on the construction of this thing. And I think what impresses me the most about this ride is the sort of gimmick of, you know, at one point, you know, this ride system is developed in such a way that, you know, you're looking out at chunks of track where there are huge gaps.
Yes, I saw this.
Coaster car is supposed to jump them, and evidently an amazing ride system that allows you to do just that.
Yeah, so one of the things I really enjoyed seeing in Bio's photos of Donkey Kart, Minecart Menace, is how it's basically two tracks, one on top of the other, with like a 4-foot gap between them, and the gears or the wheels that hold the roller coaster down. There's basically two sets of them. One that looks like your ride vehicle wheels, but then there's one below it on the track that you're actually running on that's 4 feet lower than the ride vehicle, which is really interesting. It's going to be a nice effect. Also, some other news coming out of Universal. Their drone show is coming this summer. It's called Sensational, a symphonic spectacular. And Jim, I think if you can say that 10 times fast, you should get premium seating at whatever the show is.
Okay.
So, but some details. So 4K projection mapping, new music based on popular Universal films, 600 drones, Jim, and 228 fountains with water that will reach height over 100 feet tall. That's a lot of stuff right there.
It's an impressive physical plant, you know, that and I also, you know, I've seen some of the previous Lagoon shows at Universal Studios Florida, and they're no slouches. They lean very heavily into the Universal film catalog, and they do a decent job. So I'm genuinely looking forward to Sensational.
And as a reminder, the Disney Springs drone show, Disney Dreams That Soar, runs May 24th to September 2nd. So it's possible, Jim, that we could see both drone shows in the same night over the summer.
That might be cool to try to do. Okay, let's see if we can do that.
I'm thinking, I don't know what the range on these drones is, but we might be able to have a really interesting looking drone fight somewhere over between somewhere in the middle of I-4, like somewhere at exit 70 would be, you know, really interesting. 68.
All right. Okay, so the shark drones versus the jet drones. Okay.
Exactly. All right. Last bit of news. Disney announced Bay Lake Tower is getting a year-long refurbishment running from September 2024 through September 2025. And a lot of this will be room refurbishment, but some of the property will actually be refurbished as well. And Jim, I do note that this is a DVC property, so it going offline, or large chunks of rooms going offline, will lower DVC availability in the all-important Magic Kingdom resort area. And I note without a hint of skepticism, Jim, that this is roughly the first 9 months or so, at least, the new Poly DVC tower will be open. And that one way to boost demand for a new DVC is to reduce supply of existing DVC? I'm just saying.
Also worth noting here that the Bay Lake Tower opened in what, 2009? So it's been 15 years.
It's due.
So,
15 years, yeah, it's due.
Yeah,
it's due for a major redo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was asking around about, like, you know, when the Poly DVC Tower is going to go on sale and stuff like that. And so I got to hear some numbers around existing DVC sales. And I hear that sales of Fort Wilderness Cabin DVC have been slower than molasses in winter. Have you heard this?
No, really? Okay.
So my understanding is that Fort Wilderness is selling the equivalent of around 110 to 115 one-week stays per month. So one-week contracts, you know, per month are selling about 110 to 115, using August as the average month for points. But to put that in perspective, the Riviera, which I think is the most expensive DVC, is selling the equivalent of around 250 one-week stays per month, using, again, August standard view, one bedroom as a rough equivalent. So Riviera is selling more than twice as many contracts as Fort Wilderness, which is interesting.
It is worth noting that the Riviera is on the Skyliner, where, You know, I mean, as lovely as the Fort Wilderness cabin DVCs are, they're still a Fort Wilderness, and it is a schlep to get from there to anywhere on property.
It's true. The thing that surprises me, though, is the fact that given all of that, we actually have a Fort Wilderness DVC. Like, all the things you mentioned, like the transportation issues, like there's a lack of dining at Fort Wilderness, right? All that stuff that you don't have at other DVCs. Like, why make it a DVC? I guess everything has to be a DVC at some point, right? It's like you've seen the biological meme that says eventually everything turns into a crab.
This is true. Okay.
All right, Jim. On to listener emails. This one is from Stephanie in Yorkshire. She says we're traveling to Disney World for a 2-week holiday in August. 15 wonderful nights at French Quarter and then Wilderness Lodge. My question is about Genie Plus. A while back, there was some news from Disney about changes coming to Genie Plus, with the speculation being that you could pre-select lightning lanes in advance of stays for hotel guests. Do you guys have any inside news on this? I'm not looking forward to the stress of waking up at 7 a.m. every day to secure my lightning lanes, and would really welcome the ability to pre-select a couple of rides for each day of my stay. So, Jimmy, do you have any news on this?
I do not. I saw when this email came in, and I have reached out to sources. Have you heard anything?
No, other than, you know, I think it's still definitely happening. The change that we saw to DAZ, the earlier extension of the Disney hotel room cancellation policy to 8 days, all of that fits in with the operational and technical changes they need to make in order to provide Genie Plus reservations 7 days out, but happening by August? I don't think that seems likely as of today. I will say, Stephanie, if you're looking to lessen the burden of booking Genie Plus, you might want to look at the third-party service called Standby Skipper, which does exactly what you want. Also, on last week's show, we had a listener question on whether Disney will ever bring back in-room resort delivery, and a bunch of folks wrote in to say they'd buy more stuff if Disney just did front-of-park pickup like they used to. And Veronica says, I did my last trip with a stroller, and at least with a stroller, I can cram in merchandise in the basket underneath. But once we're stroller-free, we're not buying things. And Jim, it led me to this question for you. On a scale from our parks are complicated to visit to velociraptors are eating the guests, where does we're not buying things rank in the ability to strike fear in the hearts of Disney theme park executives?
You know, when you think about... You know, how often these days,
how many guests are being eaten?
Yeah, well, no, that's it exactly. I mean, and think about, you know, for example, how did we learn about the characters for Tiana's Bayou Adventure? You know, not from riding the ride, but from, you know, the information about the two shops that are in the post-show area about, oh, yes, you know, that we have plush versions of all the new animal musicians that Louis and Tiana collect for their big party at the end of the ride. You know, it's just sort of like, you know, this is a known component of the Disney theme park experience, the notion of, well, I'm not buying stuff because you're not making convenient. There are executives, you know, clutching their chest even as we chat about this. Like, that's the sweetest plum, so to speak. So
you think too, with the opening of a new ride, whoever is the retail manager for Frontierland would probably be standing at those cash registers saying, you know, with a little notepad that says, okay, in what room do you want me to bring this to? You know, just to get the merchandise sold.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Also, a number of listeners, starting with John Forrest, said they missed the days when Disney just put stuff in your room for you. Like, I don't think that's ever coming back. We also got an email from Rick, who says, my uncle has been a huge Disney and Disney Parks fan since the 1960s, and I credit him in large part with my love or obsession of Disney. He recently sent me a video about Beyond Big Thunder and said that he finds it hard to imagine the park without the river, the Liberty Bell, and Tom Sawyer's Island. Have you heard anything or have any insight on the likelihood of any of that surviving this expansion? So, Jim, I went back and looked, and, you know, the concept art for Beyond is, you know, as you'd expect, kind of vague about the rest of the park. But I do note that the most recent update to the long-term Central Florida Tourism Oversight Board district shows the Rivers of America still there. And I think given its size and, for example, how much rainfall that area collects, that if Disney closed or changed that whole area in some way, it would have to show up on that long-term plan, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. But at the same time, remember, if we're going by what happened out in Anaheim when Galaxy's Edge was built, back where the pony farms and Big Thunder Ranch used to be and all that, they crept in the shoreline of the Ruins of America. And it's entirely possible we'll see some sort of similar plan in play. Because remember, if what we're hearing is true, it's not just adding potentially three new lands to the back of the park. It's also an in-park hotel. So that's going to take up a surprisingly large footprint. So I would honestly not be surprised to see Rivers of America, get crept in, so to speak.
The interesting thing is there's that outlet. So if you're looking above at the Rivers of America, there's like that outlet to the maintenance bay that's roughly at like the 9 or 10 o'clock position. And they can't move that, right? Because the dock is there. They're not going to move all of that.
No.
So it'll probably be behind that or something. Okay, that's possible too.
To be clear here, that's the waterway that they, when they're servicing, for example, the Liberty Bell, I mean, it goes out that way. It then heads down the very same canal where the electrical water pageant floats are parked, and then makes its way to Seven Seas Lagoon through the water bridge over to Bay Lake to back of house to where the dry dock is. So
awesome. Okay, I didn't think of that, but that makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. All right, we also got an email from Sean who says, "Hey guys, I just wondered if you've seen the Marquise Brownlee video released this week about the 360-degree treadmill technology being worked on by Imagineering. It's a fascinating watch, and I'd love to hear your ideas about how this sort of technology could be implemented in the park someday." And I threw a link to the YouTube video in the show notes for people who want to watch it. So the inventor here is Disney Imagineer Lanny Smoot, who has more than 100 patents and is very well regarded in the theme park industry. A couple of ideas. Jim, have you seen this video, by the way?
I have. Very, very intriguing tech.
Yeah, it's Jim gives me the ability to moonwalk, something I've been wanting since the 80s. So, I'm high up on it. But I think what we're going to see here is theme park special effects first. So if you remember on the Galactic Star Cruiser, there's that fight scene at the end where Kylo Ren pulls, in air quotes, Rey towards him using the Force. And I can see that being used something like that here, right? To move things around using the Force. And I think that's actually one of the things they mentioned in the video. And so that kind of makes sense. The thing I don't think we're going to see, at least initially or anytime soon, is use of this thing by guests or for consumers. For one thing, the liability if you fall down would just be insane. Like somebody would sue almost instantly. But it very intriguing technology. Right now it only exists as a prototype of one. So they haven't mass marketed it. But I definitely see it as an effect of some kind. And then speaking of videos, a number of listeners sent us an Instagram post where someone claims, quote, "a family paid $300 for a photo op with the Evil Queen. And that person that sent that posted the video decided that the role was being played by a man." All right. So there are a number of issues with this story, Jim. First of all, there's no such thing as a $300 photo op with the Evil Queen. They might have paid for the storybook dining character meal at Artist Point, right? But it's dishonest to say that it was a $300 photo op, especially to people who don't know much about Disney World. Second of all, it's not really clear that it's a man playing the part. That's the way the video is edited. But even if it is, so what? It's clearly established that it's okay from the perspective of historical theater and from the story itself. So for one thing, cross-dressing has something like a 2,000-year history in the performing arts and in cultures all around the world. It was well known in the 19th century in Europe, where the Brothers Grimm first wrote down the story of Snow White. And second, in the story of Snow White, it's an established fact that the queen is a witch who has the power of transformation. We know this because the queen takes the form of the old peddler woman, right? And not to put too fine a point on it, but the queen takes on the form of the old peddler woman because she knows that that's what's comforting and trustworthy to Snow White. Also, the last thing, Jim, the queen manages to rack up like a dozen attempted murder charges in, what is this, a 75-minute film? Okay, I'm just saying that maybe worrying about whether she's wearing boxers or briefs maybe isn't at the top of the list of morally questionable behavior in that film.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but anybody who's actually knows anything about how the characters are portrayed at a Disney park, they're in for a rude awakening, whether it comes to who's in the mini or the mini outfit, or for that matter, like the Mad Queen, the Red Queen, who we were just talking about, traditionally in the parks is played by a guy because she's got to be giant. She's got to be huge. She's got to be physical. And for that matter, back in the 70s and the 80s, if you saw Cinderella's ugly stepsisters in the Main Street Electrical Parade, chances are the reason they were ugly is they were guys, all right? You know, just lighten up, all right? You know, just sort of, I have to say, whoever it was,
exactly,
who was playing the evil queen in that video looked killer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And this got me thinking, could you imagine if Disney did an R-rated drag queen character brunch? Like I was trying to figure out, Jim, whether the global internet has enough bandwidth to handle the demand for tickets or for reservations. That would be like, Ticketmaster and Taylor Swift would be a blip on the radar. You and I could never get into that. It would sell out so quickly.
No, not at all. If you're going into the Disney parks and working that hard at finding something to offend or upset yourself,
yeah,
you know, just go to Six Flags, okay?
It's cheaper. It's easier. You don't have to get on a plane. It's fine. Yeah, just go there.
It's local. You don't have to book a flight.
You could be home for lunch. There you go. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, Jim tells us about Stitch's Supersonic Celebration, one of the shortest-lived theme park attractions in modern history. We'll be right back.
Who else remembers spending their Saturday morning on the floor in front of the television, sitting way too close to the screen, while you hork down a bowl of, to be honest, I don't remember what the cereal was called, Sugar Pop, Sugar Smacks, Super Sugar Crisp? All I know is it had sugar in the name. Well, me personally, I can't do that anymore. I mean, the sitting on the floor part, maybe. But the eating of sugary cereals, that's a nutritional no-no these days. That's why I enjoy Magic Spoon. Magic Spoon has reinvented your favorite childhood cereals to taste great, but each serving contains 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and 4 and 5 grams of net carbs per serving. What's more is Magic Spoon is high protein, gluten-free, grain-free, and soy-free, plus it's 140 calories a serving. And what's especially exciting about Magic Spoon these days is they're now making chewy, delicious treats. These are just like those marshmallowy treats you had as a kid, only with 1 gram of sugar and 2 grams of net carbs. And they're packed with 11 to 12 grams of protein per bar. And did I mention that Magic Spoon's new, chewy, delicious treats now come in 4 flavors, which are marshmallow, chocolatey peanut butter, blueberry muffin, and double chocolate. I have to say, I'm loving these Magic Spoon treats, which come 4 to a box. They make for nutritionally smart snacking when you're on the go. And if this sounds like something you'd like to try, well, head on over to magicspoon.com/DisneyDish and grab a custom bundle of cereal and try the magic for yourself. And don't forget to add their tasty treats to your order. Be sure and use our promo code DisneyDish at checkout to save $5 off. Mind you, Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed by a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. So get your next delicious bowl of high-protein cereal at magicspoon.com/DisneyDish and use the code DisneyDish to save $5 off. We thank Magic Spoon for sponsoring today's episode. Sometimes it seems like life is just one long, endless series of chores. By that I mean, you load the dishwasher, you start the dishwasher. Once that load of dishes is done, you now have to put those dishes away. But once you do that, well then, another mealtime rolls around, which is when you then start getting the next load of dishes dirty. You see what I'm saying here? This situation is Sisyphus revisited. Only instead of endlessly rolling a heavy rock uphill, you're now forever refilling the silverware drawer. And because of this blur of chores that you always have to do, it's sometimes hard to prioritize the stuff you really should be staying on top of. Like, say, managing your finances, because if you're not paying attention to that stuff, those seemingly teeny fees for things like monthly subscriptions, they can really start to add up. That is why I am so glad I make use of Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps you lower your bills so that you can then grow your savings. Thanks to Rocket Money, I now have full control over my subscriptions. More importantly, I can see all of my subscriptions in one place, and if I see something I don't want, Rocket Money can help me cancel it with just a few taps. I especially love how Rocket Money's dashboard shows me how this month's spending compares to last month's spending, so I can clearly see my spending habits. Plus, Rocket Money will help me create a custom budget, which then makes it easier for me to keep my spending on track. Just so you know, I'm not the only one using this personal finance app. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/DisneyDish. That's rocketmoney.com/DisneyDish. One more time for the people who couldn't hear what I just said over the noise their dishwasher was making. RocketMoney.com/DisneyDish. We thank them for sponsoring today's show. Walt Disney once said that for every laugh there should be a tear, which is why, I think anyway, he would have loved Drawn to Life, that hugely entertaining, surprising, and emotional spectacle that's now being presented live on stage at Disney Springs in Lake Buena Vista, Florida. Presented by Cirque du Soleil and Disney, this is a show that I can guarantee you will captivate audiences of all ages. I saw this show during a recent trip to Walt Disney World, and let me tell you, I'm ready to go see it again right now. Drawn to Life is filled with breathtaking acrobatics, stunning visuals, and heartwarming storytelling. The creative geniuses behind Cirque du Soleil and Walt Disney Animation Studios have come together to create this show where imagination literally knows no bounds. Filled with dazzling performances, not to mention beloved Disney characters coming to life in ways you've only just dreamed about, Drawn to Life is a must-see, family-friendly spectacle that will leave you, well, in awe. So don't miss out on your chance to be part of the magic. Plan your visit to Disney Springs today and reserve your seats for Drawn to Life by Cirque du Soleil and Disney, live on stage. Set your imagination in motion.
And we're back. All right, Jim, we've been kicking around this idea for a while now. I'm glad we circled back to it. So Stitch's Supersonic Celebration was the Hindenburg of theme park attractions.
This is what sometimes just fascinates me about the Walt Disney Company. I mean, nobody is smarter when it comes to making money than the mouse. But conversely, no one is dumber than Disney when it comes to finding ways that they can save a few bucks on a project for the parks that then torpedoes said project. And as you mentioned, Stitch's Supersonic Celebration, which opened at the Magic Kingdom in Florida on the very same date that this show drops, May 6th, 15 years ago, 2009. Mm-hmm. And Len, going into it, built around a hugely popular character, star of one theatrical release, three home premieres, and at that time, two animated series as of 2017, with the debut of the animated for the Chinese market, Stitch and I, that would grow to three animated series. Also, at that point, Stitch already has a huge presence in the park, just steps away from the brand new custom-built stage for Stitch's Supersonic Celebration is Stitch's Great Escape, reimagining of Tomorrowland's Alien Encounter show, which opened in November of 2004. And again, that's just 2 years and 5 months after the original Lilo and Stitch movie first debuted in theaters in June of 2002. And, you know, then once guests experienced having Stitch burp in their face and smelling that chili dog, they could exit straight into Merchants of Venus. Mm-hmm. And that gift shop was crammed full of Stitch plush. And so you get what I'm saying, Len. You got a brand new show at the Magic Kingdom based around an already popular character, and you don't need to explain to Magic Kingdom visitors who Stitch is as they're entering Tomorrowland. They would literally walk past the marquee for Stitch's Great Escape, and it had the little blue alien hanging off of it.
Yeah, there was a minute there where Disney really tried to make Stitch a thing in the parks.
And worth noting, Len, that effort continues. Remember, just in the past year, we had the new live-action version of Stitch being shot in Hawaii. And in fact, I'm told we will get the first teaser trailer for that in theaters in just a few weeks ahead of Inside Out 2.
Oh.
And other thing to remember about Stitch's Supersonic Celebration is it was part of Disney's Living Character Initiative program, meaning that, you know, if you went to this live show, Stitch would literally turn to the audience at some point and say something to the effect of, you in the back row with the blue hat and the white shirt, what's your name? So on paper, Len, Stitch's Supersonic Celebration should have been a hit straight out of the box. And as we mentioned, the Merchant of Venus show should have started doubling the amount of Stitch plush it was selling daily. But what happens instead? After just 6 weeks of operation, Stitch's Supersonic Celebration is shut down on June 27, 2009, and is never presented again. And that custom-built, purpose-built stage for this live show, still in place, rarely if used these days. In fact, I think the last time that you and I saw performers on that stage was for Mickey's Very Merry Christmas Party. That's where they did the Totally Tomorrowland Christmas show.
Oh, yeah. And Jim, let me say that this stage has to be on the Indian burial ground that Walt Disney World is built on. It is the Bermuda Triangle of attractions. Whatever goes there dies. Like, it's not great.
But here's the interesting thing. It is the perfect example of a problem at the Disney parks that has existed for decades. And what I like to call, that's actually not my problem. You figure it out.
That sounds like a you problem.
Yeah, there we go. There we go. Okay, so to establish the premise here, when the Imagineers build a new ride show or attraction for the parks, they're in charge of that project right until they hand said ride show or attraction off to ops, and that name It exactly what it implies. These are the people who actually operate all of the rideshow and attractions at the Disney parks.
And that handoff is actually a significant milestone in the development of an attraction.
No, that's it exactly. You know, we have finished constructing this. It is now time for you to bring your people and to train them to run this ride on a day-to-day basis. Now, from the Imagineering side of the fence, they believe their job is to deliver a spectacular-looking rideshow attraction, something that dazzles the guest as they experience this new addition to the park. And whereas the stuff that exists beyond the load-unload area, that's ops department.
Terra incognita, Jim. Terra incognita.
Know.
What?
Right. You know, and ops has to maintain this rideshow and attractions queue space, make sure the guests move through the space as efficiently as possible, not to mention get funneled into that post-show gift shop as quickly as possible, because those $75 spirit jerseys aren't going to sell themselves.
Yeah.
But the interior queue space, never an issue. WDI is happy to design and build these, heavily theme them. The belief is, you know, we need to start story exposition here. It's like, get people in as early as possible. The exterior queue, again, as far as WDI is concerned, that's ops problem. Again, to be specific, that's not something that Imagineer is willing to spend its development and construction budget on. So if, say, ops wants a shaded queue space for the exterior of this new rideshow and attraction, that would then make it far more pleasant for the guests standing outside and that line as they wait to get to the interior part of the queue, which, again, typically line is in the shade and has air conditioning. They often have to wait, Len, till the second fiscal year that this rideshow and attraction is in operations. So the park can then include, as that part of that next year's operating budget, the money necessary to build a, you know, said shade structure. And
see also Toy Story Land.
Okay. There we go. There we go.
Probably the canonical example of that. All right, go ahead.
Okay. So again, I bring up this aspect of rideshow and attraction construction because there has been a decades-long battle that has been going on between Imagineering and ops in Florida. And to get back to Len's description of the Indian burial ground where Supersonic Celebration was built, to be specific here, built in a previously open chunk of real estate in the Tomorrowland section of the Magic Kingdom. It's between the elevator that takes guests up to the Astro Orbiter in Rocket Tower Plaza and the People Mover. You've got your Carousel of Progress Theater to your southeast and your Grand Prix Raceway to your northwest. And Len, what's significant about this location?
There's two things. One is it's basically a giant asphalt parking lot or concrete, whatever it's made out of. But number two, the stuff around you is at least one story tall, which blocks a lot of the wind, which would make it cooler while you're there. So not only are you stuck in hot pavement in the sun with no shade, but you're not getting a breeze either.
And let's also remember, no seating.
Right, you're standing, yeah.
When this show is not being presented, people pass through this area, you know, that somebody coming out of, say, Buzz Lightyear Space Ranger Spin that wants to then go through Space Mountain would traverse this area. But at the same time, because there's no seating, guests who wanted to experience, you know, the opportunity to speak with Stitch were encouraged to get there a half hour in advance and sit down on the blazing hot pavement. And
this is where park ops should have known there was going to be an issue, because one of the things that we know, you and I know, about Disney live performances is they don't start in the cool part of the morning because there aren't enough guests in the park to fill up a performance. That's why you'll typically see like the first big stage show performance like at 10:30 or 11 o'clock in the Magic Kingdom. But at that point, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning during summer in Florida, it's already basically the surface of Mars.
And again, the very thing that Len mentioned, because once you do that, once you, you know, that if you delay your start to, say, 11 o'clock in the morning, you can only do, you know, for example, there was an A-frame out in front of this thing that listed the six times a day that Stitch's Supersonic Celebration was originally supposed to be presented. And again, a 25-minute long show.
That's a really long time for a show out in the sun.
That's a lot. All right. Okay. So think about it. You're sitting in the direct sun on hot pavement. You're already miserable before the show starts. And then, Len, the kicker, it's a video-based show. So you have to look up at the screen, squinting in the sun, to see Stitch, to interact with him. And this is what especially makes me crazy, because Stitch's Supersonic Celebration is the third time that Florida at this point has used this particular version of the Living Character Initiative technology. I mean, Turtle Talk with Crush had debuted over at Epcot in November 2004. Monsters, Inc. Laugh War, just, 100 yards away, opened April of 2007. In all of those cases, guests are seated in a dark theater facing a large screen where it's easy for them to see the character they're supposed to be interacting with. And again, especially, this is what makes me crazy, Len. Stitch's Supersonic Celebration was actually based on two Living Character Initiative shows that had already proven to be successful at Disney's Overseas Park. There was the Stitch's Encounter show that was at Hong Kong Disneyland, opened in July of 2006. That was presented indoors next to the entrance of that theme park, Space Mountain. And then there was Stitch Live, which began being presented at Walt Disney Studios Park in Paris in March of 2008. And that was presented inside of that studio's the theme park Studio D, which at that point was just off of its production corridor or production courtyard area. So look, you know, again, two earlier versions presented indoors where it was easy for guests to see the giant screen that Stitch would appear on. More to the point, even when they weren't benches, Len, there was at least a carpeted floor. Nobody was sitting on blazing hot pavement.
They should have known.
Well, but this is the thing. The peak of the Walt Disney World going into the supersonic celebration thing is like, basically convincing themselves, like, we'll be fine. People know who Stitch is, and they love this character. They'll be willing to sit in the hot Florida sun with no shade on blazing pavement for a half hour before the show starts just to get a chance to interact.
Right. Oh, so that's right, because you got to line up like half an hour before the show, and then it's a 25-minute. So you're really committing to an hour in the sun.
Then because, again, they built this, you know, they had to build this stage to support the video screen and all that. The thinking was, geez, you know, we can't really do what they did at Hong Kong and Walt Disney Studios Park in Paris. We can't, you know, a 15-minute long show, people are going to feel gypped. You know, let's do a 25-minute long show with a live host and four dancers and two robots, and it'll end with Stitch, you know, coming on stage in an Elvis outfit, you know. So, all right, long story short, show's now 25 minutes long, and it's flabby. And again, also because it's 25 minutes long and you've got live performers, which Actors Equity tells you, you know, they're going to need breaks and that sort of thing. Only six shows a day. So low capacity. And again, Stitch can only see the people who are in the front row. So you have to get there early. And so people are miserable before the show even gets started. And anyway, show opens, you know, May 6th, 2009. Park is immediately besieged by complaints, especially about the lack of shade. And so the park immediately, it's like, all right.
I was there opening day. I saw it on opening day.
So, you know, I mean, you were, you know, direct sun pouring down on you. So what the park decides to do is like, okay, not to worry. We'll get some ropes. We'll get some fabric. We'll drape it over the area. And, you know, we'll put a temporary shade thing in. And in year two, we'll have money for an actual shade structure. And it's at this point they test it. And the performer who's doing Stitch is, I can't see the audience anymore.
Yeah. Great.
You know, the whole gimmick of the show is I need to be able to identify specific people in the audience and chat with them. And I can't see them anymore.
Can't see them. Yeah.
Now, mind you, I have been told by an entertainment veteran at Walt Disney World that he believed that Stitch's Supersonic Celebration would have had a shot, could have possibly made it, if they had opened the show in January rather than May. That if they'd had 3 months in the cooler part of the year, they would have, it's like, whoa, you know, we need to address these issues. We need to adjust how the Stitch performer can see the folks in the audience, and we'll figure this out. And by the time they got to the hotter summer months, they would have sorted all of these issues out. But to open it in May doomed the show. And long story short, 6 weeks later, Disney finally threw in the tower. They walked away from a $10 million investment, I'm told. $8 million was spent on the infrastructure, the stage, the enormous screen. $2 million was spent on the development of the show, construction of the costumes, rehearsal period. There wasn't a chance to fix it in year two. There was no year two for Stitch's Supersonic Celebration.
There was barely a month to.
If that, Now, for me, this brings to mind that 5,000-seat arena that was built at the edge of Discovery River in Disney's Animal Kingdom for Rivers of Light, which, by the way, was supposed to originally open on Earth Day 2016, April 22nd that year. And Len, you got to experience the various different shows, what the Jungle Book, Into the Jungle Book, and then the Rivers of Light. And you sat in that arena at night.
Oh, it was like sitting in a clay oven that was off, but still like it had recently been used.
That's it exactly. And it's 9 o'clock at night,
and you can feel the heat coming off the concrete because it's just enormous slabs of rock, right, that are absorbing heat all day long.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, it looked lovely, but it was unworkable as an audience member, especially if you loaded in a half hour before the show and you're sitting there sweating waiting for the show to get underway. And for me, I don't understand this, because it's like, it's not like, you know, Disney's been building and operating theme parks here in Florida since late 60s, early 70s. How is this still a problem? And by the way, just to sort of bring things full circle here, I know in discussing short-lived shows, the topic of Disney Kite Tales was presented in the Rivers of Light arena space. That actually did run significantly longer than Stitch's Supersonic Celebration. That one ran for 51 weeks, Len. It ran from October 1st. Full year, and just ended September of 2022, as opposed to, again, 6 weeks. But to circle back, though, to what you just said, so you were there on opening day for Stitch's Supersonic Celebration. Anything leap out at you then?
I mean, the heat. So there were two things. One, they picked possibly the hottest part of the park to put the stage. Like, I can't think of any place other than, you know, the middle of Tomorrowland with it's just wide open spaces, no shade, you know, to put it there. And I remember thinking, because, you know, I lined up like you said, a half an hour before the show, and I was already miserable before the show even started. And I don't even like Stitch that much. I don't think Stitch is a great theme park character. You know, and they do the show, and I think at the time Disney was trying to hype it up as like the next major big thing in the park. And I remember watching it thinking like, this is it? Like, this is the kind of thing that an ambitious high school would put on for its halftime entertainment for a football game, right? Like, wow. This is not something that it wasn't good. Like, it was like, I was like, no one's going to come see this. And the funny thing is like later on the summer after it had closed, I was walking through, it was either Epcot or the studios. I don't remember which, but I saw the Imagineer that did this, Jason Sorrell. This is before I had learned tact, Jim. I walk up to Jason. I said, hey, you know, my name is Len, you know, huge fan of Disney theme parks. What happened with Stitch's Supersonic Celebration? And he was with some friends and basically looked at me like, if I could say the two words to you that I think I should say, you know, without getting fired, I would. But I'm not, and basically looked at me, gave me the look that I interpreted correctly, and looked back at everyone else and never responded. So anyway, that's my Jason Sorrell story. I feel bad about it in retrospect, but I was like, I should have opened with a better question.
I get that. I and by the way, worth noting here, Jason has written some absolutely wonderful Disney theme park history books.
I know, this is the thing that killed me. I didn't open with a book question or anything, a history question or anything
like
that.
It's okay. It's okay.
So this thing you just screwed up. What's up with that?
He decamped from Disney in 2014 and went over to Universal Creative. And every so often, I will run into Jason at a Universal press event and that sort of thing. And always my first question is, where are the wonderful Universal history books? I mean, you did so many of them for Disney. It's like, where are the Universal books? And he's like, man, I'm trying. You know, I'm pitching.
Yeah.
They just haven't gone for them yet. You know, I mean, when you look at how Stitch's Supersonic Celebration ultimately turned out and how many theme park professionals, you know, were involved in the creation of it, and more to the point, everything that had preceded it, you know, Len, they were flashing red lights all the way.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, no, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. And if we're not fine, we can fix it in year two.
The thing I heard about it, like in background, was that, so it was a $10 million show. What I heard was when Imagineering looked at it, they thought it needed to be a $15 to $20 million show. And the budget got cut so much that it was like, well, this is what we can do with that amount of money. And that's what they ended up with. So Imagineering was like, we told you so. And then, you know, so Park Ops was looking at Imagineering. Imagineering's looking at management. Management's like, well, you know, both of you guys were just completely wrong and it's your fault. So yeah, just not great. Not great all the way around there.
No. But 15 years later, that stage is still standing.
Stage is still there. Yeah. And but it's rarely used. Like, to your point, it's mainly used for hard ticket events. All right, folks, that's going to do it for the show today. You can help support our show by subscribing over at patreon.com/jimhomemedia, where we're posting exclusive shows every week. Our most recent shows include Picture This with Jim Scholz, photo-based discussion of Buzz Lightyear, and a discussion with entertainment writer Drew Taylor on the emotions that didn't make it into the movie Inside Out. Check it out at patreon.com/jimhillmedia. On next week's show, we talk about the history of Typhoon Lagoon, including the Typhoon Lagoon movie that never was. You can find more of Jim at jimhillmedia.com and more of me, Len, at touringplans.com. We're produced spectacularly by Eric Hrissey, who'll be discussing the interplay of color, texture, and music in his new work titled A Nick Cave Sweater That Sounds Like the Other Nick Cave at Uncommon Threads, a fiber arts experience running through June 14th, 2024 at the Linwood Event Center on 196th Street in beautiful downtown Linwood, Washington. While Eric's doing that, please go onto iTunes and rate our show and tell us what you'd like to hear next. For Jim, this is Len. We'll see you on the next show.